This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our broadcast and online Main Street across North Dakota. New and more transmissible variants of the coronavirus have shown up in Minnesota and elsewhere in the U.S. and around the world. The discoveries have public health leaders concerned about the efficacy of the new vaccines that were developed to combat the pandemic. Today, we'll hear from an expert on viruses and an excerpt from the Conversations on Healthcare podcast with hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. They spoke with Dr. Angela Rasmussen, who leads the core virology team at the Viral Emergence Research Initiative at the Georgetown University Center for Global Health, Science, and Security. Here's their discussion.
Dr. Rasmussen, we welcome you to Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Unfortunately, we have this grim milestone that more than 400,000 Americans have died from COVID-19. I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners as a leading virologist, where do you think we are in terms of the pandemic's trajectory?
I think that the good news for the future of the pandemic going forward is that now we do have vaccines that have exceeded our wildest expectations in terms of their efficacy. So really now it's a race against the clock to see how quickly we can get as many people vaccinated as quickly as possible.
You've long studied the drivers of pathogenicity of viruses. You've developed mouse models looking at genetics and other drivers of how these emerging diseases spread. What do you think are the most important drivers of both infection and severe disease with COVID-19?
Well, I can tell you from a molecular perspective or a cellular perspective, I think whether a person goes into a cytokine storm or not is clearly one of the most important factors in driving COVID-19 severity. And that probably has something to do with the speed and the robustness at which a person can mount an effective innate immune response. So we've seen both in patients and in mouse models that people who have more severe disease outcomes tend to have a diminished interferon response. An interferon is the innate antiviral pathway that it's sort of like a fire alarm and a sprinkler system all in one. It will detect that there's a viral infection there. It'll let other cells, including cells from the adaptive immune system, know that. And then it will begin secreting cytokines that bring in all of these other immune and inflammatory effectors to control the infection. When that doesn't happen at first, that results in a less effective adaptive immune response, and that also results in essentially uncontrolled inflammation. What we still don't really know is what predisposes a person to have that delayed response. And it's certainly genetic. It probably also has a lot to do with epigenetics, with how gene expression is regulated. It probably also has a lot to do with other comorbidities, medical status, potentially even diet and environmental factors. So it's really complicated. There's a lot of variables involved. We can model this, and that myself is something that I'm working on, something many of my colleagues are working on, trying to look at that using animal models, also using samples from patients. But ultimately, we still don't really have a very good idea about what predisposes a person to have those types of responses that cause severe illness.
Coronaviruses, they're going to mutate. They're going to do things. That's normal. Don't get worried. But we're all humans. We worry about this. And I'm wondering what your sense of this variant. Is the vaccine effective on it?
So this is still very much an ongoing area of research, but the epidemiological evidence does suggest that both the B117 UK variant, as well as the 501Y.V2 variant from South Africa, and the P1 variant from Brazil are all more transmissible. And that's largely based on epidemiological evidence that those variants rapidly became dominant within a population, suggesting that they had some sort of advantage to outcompete other variants that were circulating within that same population. And Dr. Fauci's right, like we do expect variants to emerge, and it's not unreasonable to expect that variants would emerge that are more efficient at infecting a human host, because that's really what a virus is driven to do evolutionarily. any type of virus that has an advantage in that way and finding a new host is probably going to be under positive evolutionary selection and will take over. In terms of immunity, I mean, that's really the million-dollar question right now. We really do need to know very quickly how well vaccines are going to work against these. And new preprints came out suggesting that while the B.1.1.7 variant doesn't appear to be a problem in terms of the vaccine, the mutations in the 501YV2 variant from South Africa are another story. And we should be concerned because several of these mutations have been shown to reduce antibody neutralization. So antibodies directed at those particular sites in the receptor binding domain of the spike protein, which is an important target for antibody neutralization, do not neutralize it as well or not at all. But the good news here is that when you have serum from somebody who's been vaccinated, they're not just making antibodies to the 501Y residue in the receptor binding domain. They're making antibodies for the entire spike protein. And the same study that showed that those particular mutations resulted in a loss of neutralization were still effectively neutralized by vaccinated sera. So the serum from people, the totality of the antibodies that they made against the spike protein in the vaccine were still capable of neutralizing at least pseudoviruses that contained that spike protein. So that suggests that even though there are these mutations that can escape antibody neutralization, overall, the antibodies are generating a response that's still protective. But one thing people should keep in mind is that we don't actually have good correlates of protection for vaccines right now. The bottom line here is that vaccines should probably still work against these new variants, but we do need to do more genomic surveillance to see other variants that might emerge in the future, especially as more people get vaccinated and there's going to be increased selection pressure on the virus to mutate further to evade those antibody responses that these vaccines produce. Again, we need to vaccinate as many people as possible, as quickly as possible, and keep looking at the virus to make sure we don't need to adjust the vaccines in the future.
Well, we have seen the arrival of the vaccines, the speed at which they were developed, the safety testing with which they were developed is really one of the few bright spots in this pandemic. There's still a lot of vaccine hesitancy, a lot of mistrust about the vaccine. Give us what you use as your best, both scientific and layperson argument for why the vaccine really is both safe and effective as we're trying to communicate this message out to people and get them to take advantage of the fact that the vaccines are here today.
It depends really on what people's concerns are, because there are a lot of different reasons, many of them justified for being hesitant to take these vaccines. I start usually by reminding people that these vaccines and the speed at which they were developed and their efficacy, which again has exceeded our expectations, is really one of the greatest scientific achievements of my lifetime. And we should really regard it as that. Getting deeper into it, I think it's really important that we engage with people with what their actual concerns are, and we should do so seriously. Certain aspects of vaccine hesitancy can be associated with these more extreme views, and often with people who are not going to be convinced that vaccines are safe or effective no matter what you say to them. I think we need to stop approaching vaccine hesitancy as if all people are coming from that space, because I think many people who are concerned about the vaccines really do have legitimate concerns. And for example, people want to know if these vaccines were developed so quickly, and this pipeline normally takes years and years or even decades, then how do we know that these vaccines actually do work and are safe? And how I explain that to people is just that we normally develop vaccines as a sequential process. So we start by spending a couple of years designing the vaccine, then we spend a couple more years testing it in animals, then we spend a couple more years doing phase 1/2 trials, then we finally spend a couple more years after that doing phase 3 trials that usually go for a lot longer because we're also looking at vaccine durability or the amount of time at which the vaccine can provide protection. In this case, we did many of those things at the same time. So the vaccines that are ahead in the race, the ones that already have authorization, are vaccines that can be designed using computers. So it doesn't take a long time to design them. It doesn't take a long time to manufacture them. We already had some data suggesting that mRNA vaccines are safe from other phase one trials that had been done before the pandemic. So we were able to move right into phase one clinical trials while doing the preclinical animal studies at the same time. Now, the phase three part of the process was done in a more rapid period of time because we decided not to look at durability. And that's really the one thing that's been sacrificed. So we still used tens of thousands of patients that would normally be used. The trial sizes for the phase three trials were the same. We just didn't look at durability, but that's still going to be looked at long term. It's not that we're not going to look at that at all. But the number of people that we looked at in the phase three trials is comparable, and that allows us to look at safety, at least short-term safety, within this time frame very effectively. We didn't really sacrifice anything. And using symptomatic COVID-19 as an endpoint for the trial, rather than looking at something like infection that may be harder to measure in asymptomatic people, allowed us to get efficacy data very quickly. So we really actually didn't sacrifice that much in terms of what we found out about how these vaccines work. Now, that's not the only form of vaccine hesitancy. Others are concerned about whether the vaccine is going to be safe for certain subgroups of people, and in particular communities of color, because historically those communities have been terribly exploited by biomedical researchers. And it's completely reasonable, I think, to be concerned that the vaccine is going to be, you know, inappropriately tested or inappropriately used, and that those communities are going to bear the burden of that. And in addition to that, actually, I think that those communities are disproportionately affected by the pandemic because of disparities that exist due to racism. So I think that it's really important also to engage very seriously with those concerns, and in many cases to have trusted messengers. So people from their own communities, community leaders, church leaders, faith leaders, as well as physicians from within those communities, and nurses and other providers and scientific researchers, communicating exactly why those vaccines are more important for the higher risk communities to be taking than not, and that ultimately these vaccines save lives. It's really hard, and it's going to be a long uphill struggle. And some people are just saying, well, I'd rather wait and see. And sort of by necessity, most people are going to have to wait and see, because we don't have a sufficient supply to vaccinate everybody on demand right now. So I think that we need to be thinking about vaccine hesitancy as a longer term problem. What we really need to be thinking about right now at this moment is how we're going to improve distribution. Because right now, the demand greatly exceeds the supply, and the ability of vaccine suppliers like yourself, Dr. Flinter, to give the vaccine to everybody who wants it and everybody who needs it. So I think we need to be thinking about all of these things, but we also need to be thinking about what is the most urgent problem facing us right now, and that is vaccine distribution and supply.
We're speaking today with Dr. Angela Rasmussen, who leads the virology team at the Center for Global Health Science and Security at Georgetown University. I don't want to say the virus has a consciousness, but it seems like it's finding ways to survive, and that we've got to have more clinical trials that are going on. I take it on that first clinical trial, the durability test will still go on because that trial is going on. Talk about what other things are happening in the background, because I would assume that we want to do other types of trials, not only on vaccines to deal with the current genomic makeup of the virus, but we also want to look at all these others. Who's leading that? The pharmacy industry who are putting out these, but where in the scientific community they're saying, hey, wait, we need to start running some parallel studies to look at opportunities that might be in front of us.
There are academic studies going on, as well as studies that are sponsored by the pharmaceutical industry. And when it comes down to testing products, whether they be vaccines or therapeutics, academic institutions are not capable of making a product that will be sold on the market. They don't have the manufacturing capacity. They don't have the regulatory resources, things like that. So ultimately, if you're talking about something that's going to be used for the public, unless it's something like convalescent plasma, that's not really a pharmaceutical product, you're really talking about making sure that you are partnering with a pharmaceutical company. But that said, you know, there are plenty of academic institutions that are running trials with existing drugs using things like, well, I hate to even mention it, but back when we were all talking about hydroxychloroquine, a number of different academic institutions were running clinical trials with that because it's an already available existing mm-hmm. generic drug. And in that context, you don't need a new manufacturer to make a new drug. You're just using something that's already there. And so you can test it out in your own medical center, doing a clinical trial with that. For new vaccines, all of them have a pharmaceutical partner because they will certainly need somebody to manufacture and distribute that vaccine, as well as to seek FDA approval, which is a very expensive and cumbersome process. Around the world, though, there are numerous trials going on for both novel therapeutics, repurposing existing therapeutics, and making new vaccines. And there are many vaccines that are at different places in the development pipeline. I think the last time I checked the tracker, there were over 300 different vaccine candidates. Some will only be available in certain countries. And so this is where organizations like the World Health Organization come into this. And I think that is something that hasn't gotten as much coverage here in the US just because our prior president expressed intentions to withdraw from the World Health Organization and did not participate in the COVAX group, which is a consortium of countries led by the WHO, by CEPI and Gavi, which are two vaccine organizations, to develop vaccines and manufacture and supply them to the entire world. And this is something we need to be thinking about long term. It's not necessarily developing new vaccines, but it's figuring out how we can take the vaccine supply that we have, get it from wealthy countries like the United States, and make sure that they are being equitably distributed worldwide. Mm-hmm. Because especially in places that don't have as much healthcare infrastructure, low and middle income countries that may not be able to purchase millions and millions of vaccine doses, it's going to be absolutely critical that we still find a way to get vaccines to all the people in those countries. Because this is a pandemic, and by definition, it's affecting the entire world. This isn't going to be over once we reach the herd immunity threshold in the United States. This will only be over when we reach the herd immunity threshold globally. Mm-hmm. That, I think, is something that I'm hopeful that the new Biden administration will be more involved in, is really working with international partners collaboratively to make sure that everybody in the world can have access to these vaccines. Because until all of us are safe, none of us are safe.
You know, Dr. Rasmussen, I'd be curious for your thoughts on what we've learned. I think back to the days in New York last spring, and your heart just goes out to all of our clinical colleagues who had so little tools to work with, you know, aside from all the worries about PPE and so forth. We just didn't know a lot about how to treat this. And my guess is that we have learned some very important things about how to treat cytokine storm and how to treat other overwhelming viral infections like that. And I wonder if you could, it's kind of a complicated question again, but both comment on what we've learned about the care of the individual and what we've learned about what we need to do as a public health community whenever a new threat like this arises down the road.
Yeah, I can try to tackle that in general. And it's probably going to have to be the latter question about preparedness, because I'm not a physician. I don't treat patients. And the only thing I can say about that is that it's clear from talking to my colleagues who are physicians, respiratory therapists, nurses, who are treating patients, that you know, we have come far in how we treat people who have severe COVID, at least. But really, we don't have a lot of really good targeted strategies. Our antiviral drugs are only really effective. They're kind of effective, but they have to be given as early as possible. And given that they're all delivered by IV infusion, it can be very difficult to do that at the time of diagnosis. We also don't have a sufficient supply to be treating everybody who tests positive for SARS coronavirus 2. With therapeutic monoclonal antibodies, for example. It's been a disappointment that we don't have better antiviral therapeutics. In terms of treating the cytokine storm, a lot of the clinical trials for existing drugs that target specific cytokines, such as tocilizumab, which targets IL-6, which is a major pro-inflammatory cytokine, have really been also disappointing. They've really showed no effect or therapeutic benefit. The only thing that has is a really old drug, but that's also a very, very potent broad spectrum anti-inflammatory steroid, and that's dexamethasone treatment, which does have a significant mortality benefit, at least for patients receiving supplemental oxygen. So we've come a little ways, but we still have a long way to go, I think, in terms of translating what we know about the pathogenesis of COVID-19 into treatments that will be useful in the clinic and will be available to a lot of people who need them. I think, though, that in general, for public health and being prepared for other pandemics that will happen, because it's not a question of if, but a question of when. There are thousands of other circulating coronaviruses alone, plus there are 24 other families of viruses that can also have the potential to be human pathogens. And in a sense, we should count ourselves lucky that that something like this emerged instead of something like a more transmissible Nipah virus, for example, that has a much higher fatality rate. We need to be prepared, though, for that disease X to emerge in the future. And that means basically increasing our investment in research across the board. And that's everything from basic research, surveillance, basic virology to understand better how these viruses work so we can try to find some of their weak spots, all the way up to translational things, looking at new vaccine platforms that could be used to generate new vaccines against a novel pathogen very rapidly. Things like, how would we potentially take mRNA vaccines, for example, and be able to start manufacturing them right away without necessarily needing to do a phase 3 clinical trial? How would we be able to speed up the process? And I think the vaccine Operation Warp Speed, the expedited vaccine review process, does give us a starting point, at least for removing some of the regulatory roadblocks and red tape that sometimes get in the way of this. But ultimately, I mean, I think you can't always fix problems by throwing money at them, but you also can't do meaningful research if you don't have funding to support it. And historically, with coronaviruses anyways, but many other emerging viruses, when there is an epidemic of a novel emerging virus, and this is true for SARS, for MERS, and I hope it won't be the case for SARS-2, there is an immediate influx of funding as people are paying attention to the crisis. And so people drop everything and start working on these viruses, and then that money goes away. So they can't renew their grants. Any research they were conducting on the virus will stop because they can't afford to keep doing it. We really need to stop funding scientific research, especially that has important pandemic preparedness implications, with this boom and bust cycle of funding. If we really want to be prepared for the next pandemic, we need to make sure that we're doing the research before that virus emerges and not scrambling to find out about it afterwards. Well, and that means that we're going to have to make a significant investment without an expectation of a payoff, because that's the irony of pandemic preparedness research. If you're actually succeeding at it, then it looks like you're not doing anything because there's no new pandemic. I would hope that people are, as they're more interested in science and viruses in general, which is a wonderful silver lining anyways of this pandemic for me, I hope that people will also remember this for some time to come and understand why we need to put more effort into preparedness measures like this.
We've been speaking today with the renowned virologist, Dr. Angela Rasmussen, at the Center for Global Health Science and Security at Georgetown University. Dr. Rasmussen, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you.
Conversations on Healthcare hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter with virus researcher Dr. Angela Rasmussen. You can hear more conversations at chcradio.com. Coming up on Main Street, how you can take part in the All of Us Research Program. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The Senate Appropriations Committee is considering a $2 billion bonding bill as introduced by Fargo Democratic Senator Tim Mathern. It's one of three competing ideas for bonding. Governor Burgum has a $1.2 billion plan, while the GOP legislators have an $800 million plan. Mathern says his plan lays out three priorities: infrastructure, education, and housing.
Essentially, infrastructure is for everybody. We all need it. The education piece is for our future. We need new people with new ideas. That's education. And housing is meeting the needs of our citizens right now, which are unique.
Mathern says there are no specific projects laid out in his bill. He says the Republican plans do have specific projects, which makes it more of a Christmas tree bill.
I would say personally, I have a degree in public administration and not a degree in creating Christmas trees.
Mathern says the bonds would be repaid through the proceeds of the legacy fund or the profits from the Bank of North Dakota. A Grand Forks lawmaker wants to allow essential workers to make a workers' compensation claim if they caught COVID-19 while at work. Democratic Representative Zach Ista says these would include law enforcement officers, firefighters, health care workers, teachers, and child care workers. Ista says his argument is that these are essential benefits for essential workers. He says many of them have risked their own lives to keep others safe.
We need to find a way to recognize the risk that these essential workers took on our behalf. But this session, where we've already said no to whistleblower protections for these workers, we're considering several bills that are likely to pass that will close the courthouse door to these workers who suffered injuries. And if we say no, that they can't get workers' compensation either, I think the message we're sending to our workforce is tough luck. Thanks for what you did, but we're not going to back up those words with real actions. And I think we can do better than that.
The bill creates a rebuttable presumption that the applicant was infected on the job. That didn't sit well with the Greater North Dakota Chamber President Eric Spencer. He told the House Industry, Business, and Labor Committee,
"A virus, while COVID-19 is very serious, is a much, much harder thing for an employer to prevent against, which is why this legislature has never passed a presumption of this type."
The committee voted 12-2 for a do not pass. It now goes to the House floor. And the state Senate has defeated a measure that would allow medical marijuana patients to grow their own plants. The bill would limit a personal grow center to 8 plants. Edinburgh Republican Senator Yana Myrdal says the Senate Judiciary Committee gave the measure a unanimous do not pass recommendation after law enforcement raised concerns.
"Some of those plants can be quite large and produce several pounds. Plus, there's no way of controlling the THC level. And if I can speak for myself personally, I think there's no other drug with any effect like this has that we are allowed to manufacture at home or crush up and make our own aspirin or anything like that because of the side effects and the effects of it."
The bill's main sponsor, Minot Senator Ole Larson, told the Senate he introduced it because he thinks that's what the supporters of the original medical marijuana initiated measure wanted. The bill failed on a 42-4 vote. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Brooke Allen. She's an outreach and engagement manager for the All of Us Research Program, which is being conducted by the National Institutes of Health. And she joins us to talk about this very interesting All of Us research. Brooke, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Doug. Excited to be here.
Give us a sense of what this is. What is the All of Us Research Program?
The All of Us Research Program is a very large-scale research program. The goal is to help researchers understand more about why people get sick or why certain people stay healthy. The program launched for national enrollment back in 2018. And to date, we have over 360,000 participants that have joined our program with over 300 research studies that are tapping into the data. But our goal is to get to 1 million participants or more.
And this is the National Institutes of Health, so this is a government program we're talking about.
Yes, that is correct.
Does this have relevance to the pandemic? That's the big health story right now.
That is certainly the big health story right now. And All of Us is happy to say that we are doing current active COVID-19 research. Our participants are being asked to complete something called the COVID-19 Participant Experience, or COPE, survey. That's going to ask our participants about how the pandemic is affecting their physical and mental health, to get a sense of how the pandemic is affecting our participants in the various ways that it can affect them. And since the ways that the pandemic could affect your health might, of course, change over time, our participants are actually asked to complete the COPE survey once a month for the duration of the pandemic. Aside from that, our program is also doing some work with antibody testing on the genetic samples that we have collected to see if we can learn more about when and where COVID did arrive in the United States.
So you're talking about a couple of different ways of testing or surveying people. One is, filling out a survey, and the other might be a genetic test?
Yep. So as a participant, we're going to ask you to share a couple different kinds of information. So we'll ask basic questions about your name and where you live. We might ask questions about your health, your family, your home, and maybe even where you work. If you have electronic health records, that's another way that you can participate in the program, is by sharing those, what we call EHRs, or electronic health records, with the program. And finally, like you mentioned, we might ask if you'd like to submit a biosample kit to submit a saliva sample, which would be used for a DNA analysis.
Brooke Allen is with the All of Us Research Program, and you contacted us because North Dakota, like many parts of our country, has communities that are underrepresented in your research goals. Who would you like to see better represented?
There are several groups that we are trying to target specifically. Now, in North Dakota, that's been recognized as a region with a high percentage of what we call underrepresented in biomedical research populations. And in North Dakota specifically, that looks like those folks who live in rural areas.
How do they take part? How do we help you out here?
That's a great question. So what we're doing right now in local communities is reaching out and doing a lot of education virtually, since, like you mentioned, we are in the midst of a pandemic. So we do events virtually where we educate people about our program, what the goals are, and we let them know how they can participate from home, from a safe distance, if they so wish.
So what kinds of questions do you ask? You ask if they have insurance? You ask if they have a certain economic status, if they have pre-existing conditions, et cetera?
That's a great question, Doug. We would ask questions about their health, their family, their home, their work. It would not necessarily, we're not a medical provider and we're not an insurance provider, so we're not going to be collecting that type of information. But this is all about the interaction of your lifestyle with your genetics and your environment. So those are sort of the three factors that we are concerned about: our lifestyle, genetics, and environment.
During the COVID-19 pandemic, we've been told a few times that there are various groups of people who seem to be more at risk. Maybe it's because of the kind of job they do. Maybe it's because of their health history or whatever. But are you looking for diversity here in your sample?
We are certainly looking to make sure that our population that we are collecting data from is as diverse as possible. Now, diversity in our research program is important for a lot of reasons. Where we live, how we live, and our background can all affect our health. And many groups have been left out of research in the past, and this means that researchers just know less about their health in general. So by studying data from a more diverse group of people, researchers can learn more about what makes people sick and what keeps them healthy. And what researchers learn, hopefully, could learn to better treatment and disease prevention for, like our program name states, all of us.
So if everybody listening wants to look at All of Us and maybe consider joining the effort, you can go to joinallofus.org, right?
Yes, joinallofus.org/connect. There on our website, you can learn a lot more about our program. There's a newsletter that you can sign up for to stay up to date on all of the latest. And we also do have a free app available for both iPhone and Android users.
Okay, that's handy. You mentioned that the research project started a couple of years ago, back in 2018. How long is it going to run, or is it something that will just continue because the data that you're gathering is important and changes?
Yeah, well, this is a longitudinal effort, so our hope is that the program will last at least 10 years with, an extended goal of possibly going on further than that. So, yeah, the main goal is 10 years, but we hope to extend as long as we can.
You mentioned that you might ask for a genetic test. I've already had one, and I know lots of people who have had them. They've been rather recently introduced in our area, and I know other parts of the country. Would we make available the result of our genetic test to all of us?
You can certainly share whatever electronic health records that you have with the program. If you already have DNA analysis and that's something that you'd like to share with the program, you are more than welcome to do that. All information that you can share with us is certainly valuable.
Well, you mentioned that, you know, we all have, or most of us have, these electronic health records now, and there are obviously issues of privacy with them. But if I were to say to you and my healthcare provider, you know, make my electronic health records available for this particular project, is that what's necessary? Is there a process I go through, or am I informed about what I need to do on the All of Us website?
Yes, you will be walked through the process of sharing your electronic health records in the enrollment and then subsequent participant process. It's very streamlined and easy to use. And I do want to mention, if you are not comfortable sharing your electronic health records, that's something that is absolutely not mandatory. In fact, any level of participation with the program is not mandatory. One thing that we pride ourselves on is that our participants are partners in the program. So we like to empower our participants by letting them tailor their level of participation to what they are comfortable with. So if that means answering the surveys and stopping there, that's great. If that means the surveys, the electronic health records, the DNA analysis, the whole gambit, wonderful. But that choice is just that, a choice, and up to you.
Are there benefits to being a participant?
Yes, definitely there are benefits to being a participant. So you're contributing to research that might, you know, affect the health of generations to come. Also, we talked about having that really diverse group of people and making sure that your specific community is represented in these studies that might lead to new findings, new treatments, new cures. You might learn about your own health, including risk factors that are specific to your family history or community, and even genetic results like genetic ancestry and traits.
So what security do you offer that my information will be protected? Sometimes this stuff gets out.
Absolutely. Your privacy is extremely, extremely important to us, and we take great care to protect it if you join. A few of the steps that we take, our information is stored on protected encrypted computers, and we limit and keep track of who does have access to that information. Any personal information like name or other direct identifiers like your social security number, if you share that from your information, would be stripped away, and your sample would then be reassigned a unique code. And finally, the All of Us Research Program has certificates of confidentiality from the government, which are meant to help fight legal demands like a court order to give out information that could identify you.
How long will my involvement last? And can I follow the progress of the research?
Certainly. So your participation lasts as long as you choose, and you can withdraw from the program at any time. But as long as you are an active member, then you will be a part of the program.
All right. Well, it sounds like an interesting study, and I'll be looking into it myself. Brooke Allen is an outreach and engagement manager for the All of Us Research Program for the National Institutes of Health. Brooke, thanks for spending time with us today.
Thanks so much, Doug.
Next on Main Street, Main Street Eats with Sue Balcom.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Support is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg. And because it's that time of the week, Main Street Eats with Sue Balcom.
Sue joins us from her farm outside of Mandan, the Root Cellars Farm. Sue, thanks as always.
Oh, thank you for the opportunity to tell you about my latest kitchen escapade.
And
how's that?
What are you doing on this escapade?
Well, you remember a little while back we talked about pasta and making your own. And I actually watched, is it salt, acid?
Oh, yeah. Salt, fat, acid, heat.
Acid, heat.
And those four words in some order.
Yeah, some order or not. And it was very interesting because one of the things I saw was the fact that these people over in Europe, they are not afraid to eat. You know, they're at the table and their faces just show sheer enjoyment as they're wiggle-waggling those pieces of pastrami and whatever else she was eating. She had no qualms about being filmed with her mouth full of food. And afterwards, it was like, oh, this is so good. She said that about 1,000 times. But I watched them make pasta. And I thought to myself, I've got to keep doing this until I get it perfect. And oh, my goodness, it worked. I made the most lovely noodles. They cut without sticking together, and they didn't like fall apart in my soup tureen. And so naturally, I had to dig out one of my farm-raised chickens from the freezer. And then I got to thinking, this is something that people need to know. They need to know about how to cut up a bird. Mm. I remember somebody asking me, I think it was my stepdaughter, asked me one day about whether I had cut that chicken up myself, because she had never purchased chicken with a bone in it.
Mm-hmm.
Which to me is, it's like, what are you buying if it doesn't have a bone in it? Injected breast, I'm assuming.
Yeah, pretty much.
And once my mother told me that those breasts in the bag are mostly injected with lots of water to plump them up and make them juicy, I thought, I got to quit buying those, even if they're convenient. Because we, my husband and I, can actually eat a whole week off of a bird. And this is how we do it. You start out, of course, finding a nice organically raised bird, I hope. That's my marketing thing for today. And learning how to cut it up. There's a billion YouTube videos out there. I actually cut up my first chicken in probably 1976. And this is how that happened. I lived in Washington State. I lived in Soap Lake, Washington, and had some friends. And we were going to have a barbecue. And they're like, do you know how to do this? And I'm like, sure, I've seen my mother do it a million times. But I have never done it myself. But I didn't say that part. And so I just took a knife, a nice sharp knife, and I cut it up from memory from watching my mother cut up a chicken. And naturally, it took me probably a little longer than it does now, and it probably wasn't as neat as it is now, but it can be done. And so if you like your fried chicken, you have to learn how to cut one up, but you can also separate that out into several meals if you cut it up. Now, if you don't want to play with knives, which I know some people don't, then you can actually, the first thing we do is we roast it. And we do this, I can't remember the chef's name, but it's called a salted chicken. A salt, a bird, and a lemon, and then your oven, of course. And so you just salt the outside. You wash your bird off and you salt the outside of it, kind of pat that salt on the whole exterior of that bird, stuff a couple lemons in its open cavity, and roast it at 450 degrees. If you have a 3.5-pound bird, it'll take about an hour, maybe an hour and 15. You want to use a thermometer to check that your thickest meat, which is either the thigh or the breast, is at about, I think it's 165 is the right temperature for chicken. Take the chicken out, set it to kind of sit, you let them sit for 5 or 10 minutes, and then you can make some gravy out of whatever dripped into the bottom of the pan. Oh yeah, don't forget to do that. If he's on a rack, please put a pan underneath him. Ugh. He's gonna drip.
Yep.
Oh yes. And chicken gravy is great.
Oh, absolutely. Chicken gravy is the best. And it's a lot of times when I'm making chicken for company, I'll actually cut off the wingtips and the neck and the butt. And I will pressure cook that with some celery and stuff and make a good stock. But you can use potato water and get those drippings out of the pan, thicken it with cornstarch. One of the things I've learned about making gravy is, first of all, you have to taste. You don't want to get it too salty because there is a lot of salt on that chicken and some of it may have fallen into the pan below. So you want to don't salt anything without checking the flavor. But right before you're ready to serve your gravy, you want to squeeze a little bit of lemon in there, probably a teaspoon to a tablespoon of lemon juice, fresh lemon juice. And that acid mixed with the fat from the chicken is what brings out a really good flavor in your gravy. So that's my gravy tip of the day. Yes, it really works good. So now my husband and I can only eat, we each eat, well, my chickens are about 7.5 to 8 pounds because I don't know what she feeds them,
big
but
chicken.
They're huge. So we usually eat one half of the breast. We share that with mashed potatoes and corn and gravy, and then save the other breast for soup. And then I cut, you know, this is one way you can get the meat off the bones without having to cut it up raw, is after dinner, you take and pull all the meat off of every part of that chicken. Except if you want to have a second meal, you save your thighs and drumsticks and put those in a little casserole dish and you warm them up with your leftover gravy. And that's our second meal that we have, which is actually pretty substantial. Then the good stuff comes out. You want to take all the bones that you saved. Oh, did I mention that? When you're taking the meat off of there, save the bones.
Save the bones.
Save the
Always.
Meat. Save the bones. Put the bones in the bag. And you can use raw bones and cooked bones in the same bag. It doesn't matter. Because you'll want to put those in your stock pot with an onion, some garlic, dead celery. You know, like I never throw anything but the end of the celery away. I always save all those little leaves and anything that gets even slightly brown and freeze that for my soup stock. So you simmer that or pressure cook it for about 25 minutes, which is really super cool. Oh, what do you call those things?
The
Not pressure
pot.
Cookers. Yes, yes, yes. The pressure cooker in disguise. You can use that to make the best soup stock. And then what you want, and you want to do that probably as soon as possible after you're done with your second chicken dinner, because you want to put that in the refrigerator, strain the bones out, strain the vegetables out, throw all that stuff away, but put your stock in the refrigerator overnight and let the fat come to the top and get solid. That way you can scrape all that excess fat out of that soup and still have all the flavor from the fat and the bones that you pressure cooked in there. That way you don't have a greasy soup stock. You're taking some calories out of there, which it is the beginning of the year, and you want to kind of watch that a little bit. And then you want to do your soup. And the reason I say we can eat a whole week off of this is because my soup pot just continues to grow and grow and grow and grow and grow. And then we have to eat like 3 or 4 soup meals following our 2 chicken dinners. So one chicken, a whole week of goodness. You can't ask for anything more, can you?
No, you can't. I did that with the turkey too from Thanksgiving. Oh. I did that with the bones that were left from the standing rib roast for New Year's. The idea of making the broth and then making soup after that is the winner idea. It's a great idea.
And you know what? If you've never made your own turkey stock, holy crap. I would trade 2 chicken stocks for a turkey stock any day. I love turkey stock. There's something that's so much richer about it for some reason.
And it's easy to do, relatively easy to do. It just takes time on the stove, and you can be doing other things while that's happening. And then you can, you know, do the egg noodles. You can throw in canned chicken, frankly, and then put in whatever vegetables you want, the carrots, the celery, the onion, obviously. It's wonderful. And you can make a lot of soup out of one turkey, leftover turkey.
Right. This is the time of year. So that's why we save that second chicken breast, is to make that soup. You know, you saute your onions and your carrots and your celery and add your stock, and then, you know, peas. You know, if you want a vegetable soup, you can put rice and potatoes and broccoli, whatever you have in your refrigerator this time of year that you didn't use up for the holidays. So, yeah, we're all soup connoisseurs. Oh, on a final note, there are chicken tortilla soup recipes that are made completely from scratch that are stinking amazing. It's so easy to make. You just can find one probably on my website if you can't Google one for yourself. But chicken tortilla is our second favorite to chicken noodle soup. And by the way, Doug, did you get your pasta techniques down over the holidays by any chance?
No, I didn't, but I'm still thinking of it. I have the device, actually, now that allows the pasta attachment. You know what I'm talking about, that big KitchenAid engine. It's on my to-do list.
All right. Well, someday we'll have to get together and make some noodles.
Okay. In the meantime, we'll be thinking about the next time we chat with Sue Balcom for Main Street Eats. It's always a pleasure, Sue.
Oh, thank you guys so much, and enjoy.
Okay. Decoded 8 Book is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, serving 3 million consumers in 9 states with electricity from wind, natural gas, coal, hydro, and nuclear.
This is Decoded 8 Book for January 28th. This Sunday will be Jim Kleinsaucer's birthday. He was born in 1977 in Carrington. And at 6'3" and 272 pounds, he became a tight end for the Minnesota Vikings football team. While playing for Carrington High, Kleinsaucer was twice named All-Region, All-State, and Gatorade Circle of Champions North Dakota Player of the Year. He also played in the North Dakota Shrine Game and the Montana North Dakota All-Star Game. After high school, Kleinsaucer played for UND, where he won a long list of awards, including All-American and unanimous All-NCC first-team pick. Kleinsaucer was selected as a tight end by the Minnesota Vikings in the second round of the 1999 National Football League draft. He was moved to the fullback position for a short time, where he quickly gained a reputation as a ferocious blocker for the other running backs. He was moved back to his natural position of tight end in 2001. Vikings head coach Mike Tice said, "If people look at the true requirements of the position, then I think they would agree that Jimmy is the best all-around tight end in the league." Minnesota quarterback Dante Culpepper agreed. "In my mind, he's probably one of the top three players on this team." Culpepper likely had himself and Randy Moss in mind for the other two. Coach Tice went on to say, "We think that Jim is one of the best. He can block at the point, he can pass protect, he can catch, and he can run after the catch." Kleinsaucer credited growing up in North Dakota for the skills and values needed to be successful in life, saying, "Don't ever take for granted growing up in this great state, because the opportunities are available if you want to succeed. North Dakota has a strong educational system, good work ethics, and positive core values." Happy birthday to Jim Kleinsaucer. Today's Dakota Date Book was written by Mary Helm. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
On Prairie Public Primetime TV tonight,
tune in to Prairie Public's newest documentary, Esta Es Mi Casa, This Is My Home, in association with Moving Lives Minnesota. It's the amazing journey of Hispanic migrant workers from Texas and Mexico to the sugar beet fields of the Red River Valley.
Watch Esta Es Mi Casa, This Is My Home, tonight at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast, we stream online, and after the broadcast and stream, you can find any Main Street show at prairiepublic.org. Friday, we'll hold our monthly journalist roundtable discussion about the stories that have been making headlines. Our news director, Dave Thompson, will be joined by Sarah Elmquist Squires, the new head of the North Dakota Newspaper Association, and Joe Radsky, the news director at KVRR-TV in Fargo. And then Matt Olin will review the new Tom Hanks movie, News of the World. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.